Well, as is customary, we like to start here on time. We know you're busy people. Good evening and welcome to the sixth and final presentation in this, our 14th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue at the back, Peggy Wright, with help from our webmaster taking pictures at the back, Haiwan Wan, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Christopher McConnell and Ryan Dowell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melke. A native New Yorker, she tells me she's originally from Queens. Our speaker tonight is a graduate of Harvard University. She received a PhD with a specialization in Russian and Soviet history from the University of Michigan in 1994 and joined the faculty of the History Department at the University of Kentucky that same year. Her first major monograph, Life Has Become More Joyous, Comrades, Celebrations in the Time of Stalin, was published by Indiana University Press in 2000 as part of its series in Russian and East European Studies. And in it, she used previously inaccessible Soviet archives to explore how in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, public celebrations were more than a mere diversion, but rather part of a reward system that valorized some citizens as the best people of the Soviet Union, while encouraging others to follow the example of these heroes. In her second major work, The Great War and Russian Memory, published in 2011 by Indiana University Press, she uses memoirs, literature, film, military histories, and archival material to show that World War I, while never officially commemorated, was the subject of a lively discourse about religion, heroism, violence, and patriotism during the interwar period. In November 2013, Karen received the Held Prize for the best book by a woman in Slavic or East European Eurasian Studies at the annual meeting of the Association for Slavic, East European, and East Eurasian Studies Convention in Boston. She's contributed articles for the Encyclopedia of Russian History, published by Macmillan Reference in 2004, including one frequently cited on the internet on Lenin's tomb. Her newest publications include a chapter, Models of Selfhood and Subjectivity, The Soviet Case in Historical Perspective, in a book called Mass Dictatorship and Modernity, published in November of last year, and Everyday Life in Russia, Past and Present, due out this spring, maybe already out, again from Indiana University Press. She's a professor and department chair of history at the University of Kentucky, where she recently taught a new class, Reimagining Russia, as part of the UK's Passport to the World series. Students reviewing her classes noted she's brilliant in the classroom. Please give a warm welcome to Karen Patron. Karen?
Thank you so much. There you go. Thank you so much for that very kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming out, and a special thank you to Dr. Coots and the entire staff of the WKU Libraries for making my welcome so warm. So I'm thrilled to be here, and thank you so much for inviting me. So this is the year of World War I, right? I discovered that centennial is only used by Americans, and what they say in Britain is centenary, right? So the centenary or the centennial of World War I is this year, and that offers us opportunity to reflect on that war. What was clear from the beginning was that there was an intense commemoration of the war all throughout Western Europe. There we go. And this is just an outline of what I'm going to speak about today. And so from the very beginning, really starting in the 1920s, there were built very impressive war memorials, and these were places that people went to as a way of understanding the war, of mourning their losses, of commemorating the nation, and there was a very intense culture of commemoration that developed in Western Europe. And here you see the cenotaph in London, and you can see that this is a memorial that has resonance and importance throughout history. It's, you know, was created in the 1920s, but here is the Queen leaving a wreath. I believe that was last November for Armistice Day. So you have a vision of a society commemorating this war in very complicated and complex ways, but over time. Oops, wrong direction. Here, another case, you have the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Paris. This was also created in the early 1920s with the new, something that had not had been done before, the Eternal Flame, which was to denote the eternal remembrance of the fallen soldier. Another thing that was significant about the Tombs of the Unknown, of course, was that nobody knew who was in the tomb, right? So it could be any soldier who was missing, any soldier who, you know, whose body could not have been repatriated. So it became a site of mourning for the entire community because this was a site that was denoted as sacred and really encompassing the loss of the entire community. So this was a very active commemoration culture in Western Europe and in Germany as well. In recent years, there has been, in addition, a scholarship about this memory, really starting in 1975 with Paul Fussell's The Great War in Modern Memory, whose title I rip off. Titles are not copyrighted. In any case, and he made the argument that World War I was a tremendous turning point in European culture of the 20th century, that it created a rupture in European thinking and created a new modern ethos. So this was a very important intellectual work that, you know, going back all the way to 1975, that engendered a lot of debates about the meaning of World War I. Another historian by the name of Jay Winter challenged that notion that World War I created ruptures, and he made an argument that, in fact, the commemorations for World War I in the 1920s and beyond were heavily reliant on traditional and religious discourses. So it wasn't so much about a modern ironic memory, but about re-embracing again traditional ideas of heroism and religion in this moment of commemoration in order to heal the wounds of the war and to kind of accomplish mourning and to have that mourning be successful so that you could sort of move on to the next phase. Now, one of the things that Jay Winter also argued about in his work, or suggested, was that it's important to keep in mind that memory is always contested, that it's unstable, plastic, synthetic, and repeatedly reshaped. So it's not as if there's one memory of World War I that just kind of stays in place. In fact, it has to be renewed, it's argued over, there's a contest over it, and this is the sort of the central theoretical premise of my work, is that memory is always and ever contested. And so people are always fighting over it. And think about those tragic shootings in Connecticut. When they name the number of victims, sometimes they name the mother of the shooter, and sometimes they don't, right? So even there you can see the kind of contest, you know, so where society is trying to figure out, you know, is the mother of the shooter who let him have those guns, is she a victim the same way that the children were victims, right? So you can see, and really in any commemoration, the kinds of different strands of memory that compete with one another. And that's the premise that I'm working under, and that's the premise that Winter and you know, Fussell too was working under, that there are competitions for how different kinds of memories would be recognized, and some memory is more successful at gaining a public audience and gaining a wide audience than other memory. Now, all of this memory about World War I. This was a broadsheet of a heroic Russian battle in the first days of the war in 1914 before it became clear how difficult the Russian war effort was going to be. The first year of the war, they do okay for a little while, and then they begin to really struggle in 1915, in part because they, like all of the other European powers, didn't have enough ammunition and guns, ammunition in particular. They had no idea how wasteful of lives and ammunition this war was going to be, and they were a little bit slower than the other combatants to get their ammunition restocked. So 1915 was just a disastrous retreat for the whole year, practically. In 1916, they actually turned the war effort around, and you know, one would have to argue that the reason why the Russian war effort collapses in 1917 is really the politics at home and not the politics on the front. The army dissolves, but in the spring of 1917, but only after the political revolutions in Petrograd overturn the Tsar, and the peasant soldiers think that now is the time they're going to get the land that they've been dreaming of all these years. And if they're on the front, they're not going to get the land, so they better go home. And so, in some sense, in the spring of 1917, the army dissipates by itself. So Russia's World War I was a kind of complicated war, right? It was a war that they went into with great bravado, as you can see. They did very poorly at certain points of the war, humiliating, disastrous retreats. And they do, sort of pull things together somewhat, but then the war actually ends the Tsarist government. So the war turns into revolution, and they don't have a victory. Even though they're on the Allied side, they are not sort of remembered as victors of the war, because they had to make a separate peace before the end of the war because of the revolution, the revolutions of 1917. Now here's Lenin, one of the notable things about Russian history before I wrote this book was that there was not a single word about Russia and Russian memory of the fallen in this Western European literature about World War I. And most people thought that was because when Lenin and the Bolsheviks came to power in 1917, they rejected the war as an illegitimate imperialist war. And they saw it as tragic because it tragically pitted the working classes of the different combatant countries against one another. And so it was profoundly illegitimate and not worthy of commemoration. And so in the early days of the Soviet Union, there were no major public monuments to the war, no great cemeteries for the World War I fallen, no armistice on Remembrance Day. On the contrary, sites that were dedicated to the remembrance of the war before the October Revolution were allowed to fall into disrepair, and many were ultimately demolished to make way for Soviet construction projects. So there were historians who looked at British, French, and German memory of World War I, and everyone said, well, there was no Russian memory of World War I, because, in fact, the Russian government did not commemorate the war officially. But that didn't make a lot of sense to me, because from the point of view of impact, the impact of World War I was demographically much greater than in Western Europe. Not proportionally, because the other countries had smaller groups of men to send. But there were 18.6 million men mobilized for the Russian army who had been in uniform. There were families who were mourning 2 million or more dead. There were 5 million hospitalized for wounds or disease, seeking to recover their health or learning to cope with their disfigurements. And there were 5 million who endured the hardships of prisoner of war camps. And I found it a little hard to accept the idea that all of this, that nobody remembered this war, even after this, very very deep involvement and, very great number of people, greater really than the other combatant countries who had been involved in the war. And I think that the problem was that previous scholars had conflated the absence of official state commemoration with an absence of memory. The millions who suffered during the war, the families of the dead, the injured, the prisoners of war, did not forget World War I. And especially in the first decade after the war, Soviet individuals and institutions actively participated in a transnational discourse of war memory. One telling but often overlooked episode is the enthusiastic and warm reception of Erich Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front. Now, that took the world by storm when it was immediately translated into all different languages when it came out. It was extremely popular and important work. And in fact, when it came out, it was translated into Russian. It was disseminated in a large number of copies. Many people greatly admired that work in the Soviet Union. Later on, it did disappear, because when Remarque produced the second volume, it was anti-socialist, and after that, Remarque was not so popular. So I would argue that the World War was not a central part of the Soviet state's foundation myths. It's true. It's not in commemorations. It's not in memorials. But that nonetheless, there was a really interesting discourse about World War I that was a significant aspect of Soviet culture in the interwar period. And while the memory of the war was not privileged, neither was it suppressed. And there are lots of different aspects of the war. And I'm going to look at here my arguments. This is a book cover of a book that was republished 8 or 9 times. It's basically an expose about the soldiers' experience of war. Now, some of these things were very Soviet in their take on the war, and they really like to emphasize, for example, the bad officers and the good soldiers. This is a very Soviet way of looking at the war. But nonetheless, they were talking about the problems and issues of the war, and were printed and reprinted repeatedly in the 1920s. This was a war memory that was actively developing through the 1920s and into the first half of the 1930s. And this memory was consistent with some European memory in that it challenged the idea that war was heroic. Right. So in Europe, there's a huge debate in the 1920s, and both sides are represented, that war is heroic, war is not heroic. Remarque, of course, is in the war is not heroic camp, as are many of the British poets that become very famous, made famous by, whose works are used by Fussell. But both sides of the argument existed in Europe in the 1920s and early 1930s, and both sides of the argument exist in the Soviet Union in the 1920s and early 1930s. There are aspects of the war that are actually heroized, even in the 1920s, when the Tsarist government was definitely out. But nonetheless, they opened a museum where they had some aspects, some war trophies, and some other aspects of Tsarist paraphernalia as a way of talking about the history of war. Now, the work that I published has 4 different themes that I follow through, and I'll probably talk a little bit about each one, but not. Not as much as obviously as I do in the book. So I'll kind of give you a taste of each of these categories. So I looked at issues of religion. I looked at issues of gender and masculinity, because one of the things about war is it's this moment where the state calls upon men to act in very particular ways, and if men don't enact in those ways, then they're accused of not being masculine, right? So masculinity, heroism, and national identity are very closely intertwined in war literature, and so I looked at the way that those three things kind of come together in the war literature of the 1920s. I also looked at the question of violence, because one of the interesting things in this literature is that it often does talk about violence from the point of view of the perpetrator. That is to say, these are Russian soldiers who admit the violence that they are doing to, other people, civilian soldiers, and so forth. And so it's a kind of reflection on the violence that a soldier must commit or ends up committing in the wartime situation. Then the 4th category is national identity. This is a very awkward situation for the people writing these books in the Soviet Union, because in the Soviet Union, things were supposed to be understood by class. So the German worker and the Soviet worker, or the Russian worker, were supposed to be proletarian brothers. They weren't supposed to be shooting at each other across the front. And so how do you understand this national problem? How do you understand the enemy? And if the enemy is not the enemy, well, then who's the enemy? Very often, Lenin wanted the soldiers to turn their guns against the officers, and in fact, in during the spring of 1917, sometimes that came to pass. But as they're trying to describe this problem of what does it mean to be a World War I soldier and who the enemy is, you could get yourself caught up into a big knot, because all of these problems and questions are very they're very complicated. And so I was able to use the work of the 1920s to show how people tried to deal with these complicated issues. Yeah. One of the pieces of this that's very important to keep in mind is that when Vladimir Lenin, the the first leader of the Soviet Union was extremely anti-war, in the sense that he was anti-World War I. He thought World War I was a bad war, it was an imperialist war, and that the Soviet Union shouldn't be fighting it. But he wasn't anti-war. He was a militarist who was against World War I. He was against a particular war. He was not against the idea of using war as a means of achieving political aims. And in fact, he's encouraging the soldiers to turn their guns against their officers. So he's not afraid of provoking violence. In 1915, he advised soldiers to pay no heed to the mawkish snivelers who were afraid of war. Too much still remains in the world that must be destroyed with fire and sword for the emancipation of the working class. And he urged the soldiers to keep their weapons and turn the imperialist war into a civil war. He advocated fraternization with the enemy to encourage the proletariat on both sides to turn their guns against their officers. So you can understand that Lenin is anti-World War I, but he's not a pacifist, and he cannot stand pacifism, right? You know, the idea of refusing to fight for your aims, for your political aims, is really anathema to him. But in this World War I memory that I uncovered, this theme of actual pacifism does emerge. This is Ilya Ehrenborg, who is most famous actually for his really virulent propaganda against the Germans during World War II. So Ehrenborg had a kind of change of heart along the way about whether violence could be used, and was very active in the propaganda against the Nazis during World War II. However, during World War I, he was a war correspondent on the front in France, and he had a nervous breakdown. And he wrote memoirs in the 1920s. And in this memoirs, he really struck up both a religious and a pacifist tone. Both of these things are anathema in the Soviet Union of the 1920s, right? The Soviets are an atheist state. They reject all religion as oppressive, and they were equal opportunity in rejecting all the religions. So it didn't matter whether you were Christian, Orthodox, Catholic, Jewish, Islamic, all of those religions, even, you know, shamanistic, all of those religions were out. But Ehrenborg is able to publish, and it's published in Berlin, but then it's also allowed into the Soviet Union. He was able to publish a memoir in which he says this: "Only in the ancient book, not effaced by anything, and somewhere in the depths of each of our souls, not completely trampled, lives the prohibition, 'Thou shalt not kill.'" So he's musing on the failure of the warriors to follow the basic Judeo-Christian precepts. Another pacifist writer was this fellow, is Lev Naumovich Voitilovsky. He's the one, I believe, who's looking at the camera. This was a photograph from his own personal archive, and this is his little encampment. Oh, he's an officer, so this is his little lunch encampment with the other officers, and he too penned an anti-war memoir that embraced a more secular pacifism than Ehrenborg. He defined war as, quote, "the greatest obstacle and the most repulsive exterminator of culture." I can't remember if I put a slide for this. Yes. Okay. "It is the destruction of all that has been accumulated by the centuries in hearts and minds, and now hurled wastefully under the feet of the armed soldiers. According to Voitilovsky, on every military banner, on the eagles, on the shoulder boards, the secret motto is imprinted, 'Down with culture. Long live destitution and the poverty of the spirit.' War demanded of the cultured person that he abandon his theories and commandments and provide only vacant endurance and uncomplaining submissiveness." So as you can see, this theme of pacifism is very different than what the official Soviet line would be. Now, mind you, this is the 1920s, and in fact, there was censorship over literature and newspapers, but these works were passed by the censor, right? This was part of the Soviet discourse. Now, it wasn't the most popular thing. It was on the margins. But sometimes if you study what's on the margins, you get to understand, you know, how it's possible to have dissenting ideas within the society. So even in the 1920s with censorship, this idea of pacifism emerges, despite the fact that that really the official Soviet idea was that you shouldn't be pacifist. Every Soviet male should be ready to pick up that rifle at any minute now and fight against the encircling capitalists, right? So this was there was a real ethos of militarism that really begins in the 1920s and gets stronger as you get closer to World War II. But these works are very different than that, and that's part of what makes them very interesting. This is a POW camp in Austria-Hungary. One of those prisoners is Kirill Levin, although he might be, I don't know if he's taking the picture, but this was from his personal file, so I can't swear to you where he is, if he is in fact in there somewhere. But he wrote a memoir that really has a tremendous amount of description of the suffering that the Russian soldiers endured in the POW camp. For example, he depicted the despair of a soldier who had been shot in the genitals and who was, quote, gradually turning into a eunuch. And Levin showed him delicately crying and holding an icon of St. Nicholas to his wounded groin in the vain hope that he might be cured. So this really, you know, sort of poignant story of this poor man and the hopelessness with which, you know, he was living his life. When this miracle did not occur, the soldier went to work in a home for blind veterans who would not be able to see his deformity. So this memoir really focuses on the fact that, hey, war is not heroic. In war, you know, your body is destroyed. The bodies of men that were supposed to be heroic are really, in fact, destroyed. He writes about another man who has smallpox and who in the POW camp and dies the most horrifying death imaginable, with his sort of body dripping off the bed. I mean, it's really hideous. He also described numerous cases of what was called shell shock in the West. And so these were people who had lost their minds because of the war, and there was a special ward in the POW camp to keep them together. And so he described some of these really tragic cases. So you can see that this is not exactly the enthusiastic, hey, war is necessary and we're going to be heroic in war. In fact, it really undercuts that possibility by demonstrating the real tragic nature of what's going on in war. And then this is Sofia Fedorchenko, who served as a nurse during World War I. And she created a very dark picture of the war and the soldiers who participated in it. She got into trouble later on because it was not clear how much of this was ethnography and how much of this was creative writing, right? You know, so she supposedly had talked to the soldiers and was using their words. She had been a nurse and she'd, you know, been at their bedsides, and so she was supposedly had recorded their words and then transmitted them. But then she admitted that she had kind of, you know, artistically transformed them, and she got into a lot of trouble in the 1920s because it was felt that from on class grounds, a bourgeois woman shouldn't be, you know, interfering with the words of the proletarian soldiers. But nonetheless, this very interesting work was published several times during the 1920s, and in it, she has the soldiers being very cognizant of committing violence. One of the soldiers describe how when he arrived in the destroyed town of Oprishny, there was nothing left to loot, so he seized a plump woman as his war booty. 3 days I kept her with, quote, 3 days I kept her with me and amused myself, and I shared her with my platoon commander. Like I would share tobacco, I shared the woman. And then I became afraid and let her go in the field. So here, both the soldier and the officer are aware that their behavior broke every law of war and every moral precept connected to the ideals of soldierly honor, but they nonetheless participated in this behavior. And so some of the stories, I mean, the stories taken together demonstrate the way in which the constant exposure to violence reshapes the soldiers and creates them, makes them more violent. And so the soldiers in her book, you know, they you know, strangle people for a cup of coffee. They engage in domestic violence. They engage in rape. They engage in plunder. The war zone is in the part of the Russian Empire where there are many Jews, and so there are descriptions of the pogroms that the soldiers make and how they deliberately target and torment the Jewish population that's in the border zone. So as you can see, it's really hard to get a vision of a heroic soldier out of here. And what's worse, from a Soviet class point of view, these are the ordinary proletarian soldiers, peasants and proletarians, who are supposed to be Soviet heroes. But, you know, Soviet heroes aren't supposed to rape and plunder. So the admission that these soldiers, the ordinary soldier, engaged in all these kinds of bad behavior in a wartime context is not very attractive to the Soviet state. So many of the Soviet works published in the first decade and a half after the war thus challenged some of the central tenets of Soviet militarization by depicting war not as a necessary tool in defeating capitalism, but as a force destroying the human spirit, world civilization, and the soul. War was shown to damage the soldier's body and his mind, emasculating him rather than making him stronger. Furthermore, in wartime, soldiers lost their moral bearings and committed atrocities against the innocent. In these depictions, war was anything but an heroic event. So that's what this discourse is like in the 1920s and 30s. Now, there's other elements of it that are more heroic, but there is this very strong, you know, sort of stream of anti-heroic discourse. When I was doing this work, I was amazed because, you know, everyone in the field said there was no World War I memory, and in fact, the most important Soviet historian who's been in every Soviet archive doing I don't know how much work said to me, I've been in the archives, I've never seen anything about the Soviet memory of World War I. You know, basically telling me my topic didn't exist. So I'm having this kind of disjointed issue where the historians are saying this doesn't exist, and then I'm reading fascinating work after fascinating work after fascinating work that nobody seems to be that doesn't seem to be on anybody's register. So then I had a kind of a puzzle. Well, why is it that nobody knows about this? In fact, in the 1990s, when historian Catherine Meridale did a poll of elderly people in Leningrad or St. I can't remember, people of a certain age in St. Petersburg, to ask them what the three most important wars of the 20th century were, they didn't even mention World War I. Right? This entire episode that had created the revolution was sort of absent from contemporary memory. And when she finally explained, you know, no, the World War One, the one where the Tsar was toppled, the woman said, oh, that, you know. So it was really absent. So we have a situation where the war is absent from contemporary, so 1990s, 2000s Soviet memory, post-Soviet and by the 2000s, and it was absent from the scholarship. And so part of what I had to do was then try to figure out, well, what happened? Where, you know, why did this, you know, sort of really interesting material disappear? Or both, you know, in terms of how people remembering it, and also in terms of people, you know, just knowing about World War I in the Soviet context. And so I set about examining how and when they disappeared from Soviet public life. And here I was able to use archival documents because you could go in and look at censorship papers. And also I had a very dedicated our research assistant who went through editions of two editions of the same work, if they were published 5 or 6 years apart, he went through and documented all the changes in the work, and you know, while this was not a very exciting task, it really yielded tremendous results because you could see exactly when things start to disappear. right? And exactly what starts to disappear? And I'm, you know, I was able to make the argument that I established that somewhere in the early 1930s, and you know, again here it's a little bit fuzzy. It's, you know, 1933, 1934, you know, somewhere in here, you know, and you know, you might note that that's also coincides with the rise of the Nazis in Germany, right? It's that, you know, it's not really accidental. But even before that, these things are disappearing. Soviet publishing houses and censors began systematically to suppress literature that cast any doubt on the heroic soldierly ideal or the efficacy of war. And a notable example was the elimination, this is the quiet close to dawn, one notable example was the elimination from all post-1933 editions of Sholokhov's novel Quiet Flows the Dawn of a scene that depicted the protagonist, Grigory Melikov, that's him on the force, this is him making his first kill, and in the novel he's very sad about it because, as you can see, the Austrian that's there is cowering, and he's not armed, and you know, he cuts him down anyway, even though, you know, in theory he probably should have taken him prisoner, right? But he kills him, and his conscience bothers him. But elsewhere in the novel, he becomes fearful in battle, and he wishes to throw himself on the ground to weep, quote, childishly to the earth as if she were his mother. Now, Melikov is not even the hero of the novel; he's kind of the anti-hero. But that scene of him panicking in battle, throwing himself on Mother Earth and crying, is taken out of the novel anyway. Right, so you can see the kinds of changes that are being made in these works as you look at them across time, and you can see that there's a system to the ways in which the censorship is being done, and the system is to eliminate anything that questions the heroism of war, and so you can understand that the Soviet Union in the mid-1930s is a militarizing state. They are becoming very anxious about they were always anxious, but about the being encircled by capitalists, but certainly with the Nazis on their borders threatening to eliminate quote-unquote Judeo-Bolshevism, the Soviets have a new appreciation for military culture, military masculinity, military heroism. And anything that undermines that, you know, that culture, anything that suggests that maybe war isn't the greatest thing since sliced bread, is no longer welcome. And so you can watch the systematic disappearance. But World War I doesn't entirely disappear from view during the 1930s, because it's the militarizing Soviet state in the 1930s became quite concerned with rebutting the notion that Russians were incapable of defeating a powerful German foe. Right? And keep in mind, this is the context of defeat. Right? They had lost World War I. They had done okay against the Austro-Hungarians, but they had lost against the Germans repeatedly. One member of the Red Army's general staff candidly explained the rationale for publicizing, quote, a series of examples when the whole German corps ran from the field of battle in panic. He was concerned that the absolute horror of World War had left a powerful impression on the Soviet population. Quote, the German heavy artillery created the common opinion that in battle, Germany knows how to use all means of fighting and all its forces very well. This pernicious influence has very likely penetrated the milieu of the rising generation as well. This officer suggested that the current Red Army commanders seemed like pygmies when compared to the powerful and prepared German commanders. Because of these phenomena, it was imperative for military leaders to present Russia's participation in the World War in a more positive light. So the closer you get to World War II in the second half of the 1930s, suddenly World War I emerges, but now with the successful pieces being brought to the fore, you know, the battles that the Russians won, and here's a good example. This is A.A. Brusilov. He is the probably the most successful commander of the Tsarist army, and he has a huge breakthrough in the spring of 1916 that almost knocks the Austro-Hungarians out of the war, but doesn't quite knock them out of the war because they're not able to follow up on it. But he is doubly good to be a hero in this context because he was one of the few Tsarist generals who, during the Russian Civil War, joined forces with the Bolsheviks. So he was a Bolshevik. He died, you know, as a Red Army commander, and in 1926. And now in his posthumous state, he is called forth over and over again because he actually came close to beating the Germans, right? And he was very successful in these battles. The military publishing houses featured his offensive in a number of publications, first as The Breakthrough on the Southwestern Front in 1916, or the Lutz Breakthrough, based on where it was, in Lutsk, I guess. And then, by 1940, they're already calling this the Brusilov Breakthrough. So they're giving him, they're making him into a military hero in a way that was not possible a few years before. He was now held up to the Red Army Officer Corps as a successful military leader to be emulated. Other works praised the heroic Russian soldier, whose accomplishments were betrayed by the high command, and positively depicted the use of heavy artillery and poison gas against the enemy, regardless of class. So what you get at the end of the 1930s is a Soviet embrace of really kind of czarist-era propaganda about World War I. Now, after the German invasion in June 1941, the experience of fighting the Germans in the First War became an essential part of propaganda, and any hint of ambivalence about the war disappeared. In 1929, a memoirist, whose name was Dmitriev, could celebrate desertion to the Austrians as a heroic revolutionary act. But in the 1943 novel Brusilov's Breakthrough, Brusilov issued an order to shoot to a man deserters and those attempting to retreat, even if this should involve ceasing fire against the enemy. The memory of the First World War had come full circle. The original jingoism of 1914 was challenged by two decades of ambivalence about war, but after 1941, war memory returned to its heroic mode, underscoring the absolute necessity to fight and die for one's country. So this is sort of the pre-war period. Now, then we have to kind of think about, so we understand why the materials that I was looking at in the 20s and early 30s disappeared, because they were deliberately censored in the second half of the 1930s and replaced with this more heroic material. But then, in order to understand why it completely disappeared, the cataclysm of World War II comes and it really wipes away sort of that interwar period, or the memory of the interwar period. And so it's very, it gets, the World War I gets really buried underneath this, sort of much more traumatic, much more recent war. And that's why in the 1990s, the people couldn't even remember World War I, right? It was very fuzzy. It wasn't part of their official, wasn't part of official culture, and while it wasn't suppressed, neither was it, sort of really made much of throughout that time. And that's, with a few exceptions, Solzhenitsyn writes a book, I can't remember if it was published there or here, The Red Wheel. There are a few, Dr. Zhivago touches on World War I, but that's also published abroad. In the interim, there's not very much discussion of World War I. It's very accidental, sort of for the most part. But then, the Soviet Union falls in 1991. And it's sort of the slate is blank again, right? Now a whole new set of commemorations, a whole new set of questions has to be sort of put forward. And very early on, the émigré officers. One of the things that happens very early in 1991 and 92 is that the émigrés who had not been to the Soviet Union for the 40 or 50 years since they had émigrated began to come back. And so some of the sort of families of the officers of World War I come back and begin to start making plans for commemorations. And so in 1994 they celebrate Armistice Day, and by 2004 there is a new memorial park to World War I on the site where the Moscow City Fraternal Cemetery was in the 20s, in the early 1930s. There are many different monuments in this park. I'll talk a little bit about this one just to give you a sense of that, of the contestation. All right, so this obelisk has four sides. One side has the hammer and sickle. One side has the St. George Cross, which is the czarist medal. And another side has, it has a Soviet saying, and the fourth side has a czarist saying. So it's all mixed up. right? There's a little bit of everything in there, because there's this is a moment after 1991, the first, you know, the first 20 years after the fall, really, everything is in flux, right? It's very hard to, at least the first 10, 15 years, everything is in flux, and so people don't know what to do. But yet, this, because this memorial was to all people who fought to defend the fatherland, and includes the whites, right? Those were the people who fought against the Soviet government during the Civil War. Right, there were the Reds, who were the Soviets, and the Whites, who were very many white. There were World War I officers who fought against the Reds, and so this monument is set up to both of them. Right, it's set up to all of the people who fought for Russia, whether you were on the Red side or the White side. Right, so it's trying to be ecumenical. It's trying to include everybody, and then several times within the decade. This monument is defaced. I don't know if you can sort of see how the stone is washed up there. It's because people put acid on it. There was a chapel on this site that was defiled, and so it's a site of contestation, because the people who had grown up in the Soviet Union were not ready to accept the white officers as heroes alongside the red officers, and so there was a good deal of contestation about, you know, whose heroes are we recognizing, who were the heroes, and this is true certainly for World War II as well. Adjacent to this this cemetery, there is a church, and in the courtyard to the church, there's even monuments to the members of the Vlasov movement, who were people who fought with the Germans against the Soviet Union in World War II. And this is extremely contentious, right? And so the question about who are your heroes in a civil war is a little bit awkward. And in fact, on the night, the anniversary of the invasion of the Soviet Union, June 22nd, originally 1941, they have to have militias out there to make sure that nobody's defiling the statues. Right, so it's the monuments. So it remains a very contested space and a very contested zone, even into the late Soviet period, or the post-Soviet period, I should say. And now it's 1914. Actually, it's 2014. Sorry, 2013. Sorry, I'm losing a year. I'm losing 100 years. Nothing happened, right? So now it's 2014, and the current Russian government has to figure out how to memorialize World War I. And the first interesting thing is that it decides that it is going to memorialize World War I. So notice that, you know, we're coming up on the anniversary. They're making some organizations. They're making some plans. They haven't really said anything about organizing the centennial of 1917 and the Russian Revolution. So here again, we have a very complicated, contested picture about what's going on in the present. And in the present, we have a scenario where the Russian state is ready to embrace World War I again, right? And the Russian state is very anxious to embrace not just World War I, but World War I as a victory. Now, considering that the Russian army didn't do very well for much of the war, and it toppled the empire, it's not really easy to think of World War I as a victory, right? So this is a kind of dilemma in terms of doing that. But the discussion of World War I talks about how Russia ought to have been on the side of the victors. It should have been standing with the Allies. But then, unfortunately, because of the revolution, the stab in the back, they were not on the side of the Allies, and they lost the victory that was, you know, they had it in their hands, and they lost it. And so this is an extremely interesting new historical moment where, as one might understand, the Russian military is trying to create a new image of itself, and it seems to have some new activities in Ukraine that were unexpected when I wrote this piece originally. But the point is that they are trying to frame World War I as a heroic, honorable battle that they could celebrate as something for the Russian nation to take pride in, right? So it's connected into this national idea, and again, you know, going back to the question about gender, national identity, you know, this is about, you know, sort of establishing a strong Russia, establishing a Russia that is militarily effective, successful, and therefore commemorating the heroic memory of this of World War One. And so, you know, just as in the 20s, the Soviet state refused to commemorate this war, in, you know, in official terms. Now, the Putin state, you know, state, you know, in Putin's last few years, is very eager to commemorate this war, and so they had a. They're doing a couple of things. They're opening a museum on the site of the Tsarist palace at Tsarskoye Selo, that is going to be an interactive exhibit about the Russian efforts in World War One. And then in there's a monument park that's a very significant place for World War II monuments in Moscow. That's called Poklonnaya Gora. There are 10 or 15 different monuments there to all different things. It's somewhere between an amusement park and a war museum. It's kind of both. You know, there are fairs there. There's Ferris wheels, cotton candy, and then an Orthodox church, a mosque, a synagogue, and a war museum. I mean, it's a very kind of multivalent place. And so they decided to do a contest. And the contest was going to be voted on with public opinion. And so they 48 people, you know, sort of submitted what you call projects. They were all models, right? And then there was a round of voting, and they eliminated some, and then there were 16 left, and then you got to vote on those, and they eliminated some, and then after the public vote, there was a professional jury, and the professional jury didn't pick the one that the public had picked. But okay, it's really interesting because one of my students had been in Moscow, and he said, "Yeah, I voted for the monument." And I said, "Well, which one did you vote for?" And he's like, "He voted for the one that had been the most popular, but that had not been picked." So it's, you know, it's interesting. That one had a kind of globe with a soldier inside of it, with the idea of sort of the soldier being under the earth. So what you have here is the winner. Now, this does not exist, right? I mean, I'm very curious to see whether it actually will exist and what it looks like when it does exist. So this is history as, you know, this is history before it's written, right? You know, this is what to look out for. Supposedly in November 2014, this monument will open on Poklonnaya Gora, and we'll see whether that in fact happens. There is a collection you can actually, if you really like it and you really want to have that, you know, big Russian flag, you can, I'll show you the both sides. If you really like that, you can go online and make a contribution, because they are collecting, you know, deliberately. The intention is that they're going to collect funds from the public, and so you too can participate in this effort. You can put in a contribution if you so wish on the website, and hundreds of thousands of rubles have been collected so far. Okay, so what do we have here? So we have, it's hard to see. So there are two pieces to it. There's a soldier, a very big soldier. You can see the, what I wanted to do is this. You can see the scale, right? You know, he's a big guy, and there's a human. And then it's a big soldier, an individual. And then there's this gigantic flag, which is red, white, and blue. You can't quite see it in this one, but it's red, white, and blue, like the contemporary Russian flag. And here's the double-headed eagle of the Romanovs. And then here is the cavalry charge going into battle. So it's got your heroic soldier here, your heroic soldiers going into battle, your Russian flag, your eagle. What else could you want? Here's another. It seems to me that the variants are, these aren't built yet, so these are kind of variations a little bit. But again, here you can see this one is much clearer. There's the red, blue, and white of the Russian flag and the cavalry charge. And then some kind of, I don't know, outcropping or, you know, I don't know what that is. And then there's this. This one is the most interesting. This is the other side, the flip side. Or maybe it's a variant, right? And you can see it's got, this one has the cavalry. It's got the red, white, and blue flag. It's got the double-headed eagle. It's got the cavalry charging. But it's also got the pietà, right? So here's, you know, sort of here's the re-emergence of that theme of mourning from the 1920s, and it's in there, right? So the contemporary moment is reflective of both sides of this issue. It is possible to see the sorrow of war, and actually some of the other, if we have time and you would like to, I can open up one of my other PowerPoints, and I have more of the variants if you'd like to see them. So you've got the Pietà, and then you have the church. So as you may have known from recent analysis, the Orthodox Church is extremely important in Putin's Russia. They've regained a lot of power, and they're very tightly connected to Putin's rule. That's why the members of the punk band Pussy Riot got into a lot of trouble because they went into an Orthodox church, right? That's, you know, they had been doing street protestations for months with no trouble, but they get into big trouble when they go inside an Orthodox church and say, I think the prayer is something like Virgin Mary, help Putin, I can't remember do what, pray for Putin, or, you know, something like that. And then here you have the civilian population. So this is a kind of interesting, it's an interesting variant, right? Because it's got everything. It's got the mourning, it's got the religious statements, which were out in the 1920s, but obviously back here. And it also has an awareness that the civilian population suffered during the war, too. So this is a very interesting monument. I'm very curious, and, you know, we'll all have to look in the, you know, we'll have to look online on November the, you know, 11th, and see what actually goes up, you know, and what is it going to look like? What variant is it when we get there? So I hope that this kind of romp through 100 years of memory has helped you to see a couple things. And one is that memory is constantly changing over time, right? You know, it's not as if there was one memory of World War I and that was it. And in fact, you know, there was in fact some events that occurred as a part of World War I in between 1914 and 1918. But ever since that moment, the way that they are understood and represented and presented and, you know, has been constantly changing based on time and context, and also, you know, very different in Western Europe than in Soviet Union. So memory is not a static thing, and in many cases, the memory is about contestation. There are different, you know, this a couple of times these monuments have just been kind of everything in the kitchen sink, right? I mean, this one in particular, it seems to me, it's like, well, we got heroism, good. We got nationalism, good. We've got Tsarist Russia, got it. You know, we've got the, you know, the Madonna, got it. Or, you know, in Russia, in Orthodoxy, it's the Mother of God, or is usually how she's referred to, right? You know, so we've got all these, you know, we've got all these things, and they're all in this variant, right? And so there's a kind of syncretism that ties it all together. But I think that we, you know, need to think about this. And then the second thing, you think about how it changes over time. And then the second thing is that it seems to me that the memory of World War I is always and ever tied to questions of militarism and military culture in the time that these memories are produced. And so this is not just about memory that changes, but about memory that emphasizes certain aspects of war because they are convenient or helpful to a particular point of view, and hides other pieces of war because they're not particularly helpful to a certain kinds of point of view. And so it's complicated, and people are, there are competing visions, but those visions are very much tied to politics in the present day. And it is certainly clear to me that Putin is interested in raising the prestige of the Russian army, and I think, you know, it's a little bit clearer why that might be now than it was a few weeks ago. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, there's a method to this madness. It's not just memory; it's memory tied into the politics of the present day. So, thank you for your attention. If you want me to show you some more variants, I'd be happy to do it. Thank you.
Good.
Good.
We have time for questions.
Yeah, back here.
Yes.
So I was just wondering, some of the anti-war or the pacifist writers, did any of their books extend into the Civil War period? So, like, did they have this bad discourse, bad World War I, good Civil War, or bad World War I? worse Civil War.
That's very good. I mean, you know, it was really interesting. The in this case, the most classic Civil War book, right, one of the most classic is Shalikov's Quiet Flows the Don. And in fact, that's complicated about the Civil War, too. It's not a... So I think that my hypothesis, and again, I've not done a lot of work with the Civil War, but my working hypothesis is that you would find the same thing in the Civil War, that the 1920s and the early 1930s allow for a kind of ability to talk about the darker sides of war and the complications of war in a way that the after the 1930s they don't. So that's my working hypothesis. And on this, Sean Guillory has an article on trauma during the Civil War that's very interesting and suggests that really in the 1920s there is this sort of moment that any war is challenged to some degree. Of course, there's a lot of heroism about the Civil War, but again, it is not it hasn't risen to the heights yet either. And then there's a complication because by the time you get to the 1930s, many of the people who were commanders in the Civil War are on the outs with Stalin. So you get a kind of in fact, you know, who organized the Red Army during the Civil War? It was Leon Trotsky, who was the most probably responsible for the victory in the Civil War. And by 1927 or 1928, nobody was going to want to say that. And so you get a kind of, so the Civil War is similarly complicated even from the beginning. Even though it's supposed to be the good war, it's not that good.
Other questions? Yes, back here.
How did you decide on what materials you can use?
Yeah, that's a good question. I tried to get a sense of everything that was out there. Now, I couldn't read everything, but I did try to at least get the lay of the land for what was out there. And I made a decision for practical reasons, because I had two small children at home at the time, and I was not really that eager to do another year in the archives because I couldn't really go. I decided that what I wanted to know what was the public discourse of World War I, so I was only going to use things that were published. Then eventually I did go to the archives to look at the backstory of the things that were published. But I set a limit that I wanted to look at things that were published, and then I set a limit that I know that February through October is a really fascinating time, and really World War I doesn't end until the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk in March 1918, but I decided that I was just going to look at how the Tsarist era was looked at. So I really basically stopped the materials are something that go, everything that goes up to February 1917. I didn't do very much at all with the Civil War. And so those were sort of limitations. But then within that, I tried, I didn't get everything. There were some films I missed, and there were some, there were certainly, other things that are out there. But I really tried to get as much material as I could. And some of this material was stuff that people had not, hadn't really put together as a body of material before. So I found myself unearthing and discovering, sort of these authors who had been really lost in the process. And so when I found an author and I thought that they were really interesting, I focused a lot on them. So there's a lot about Fedorchenko, a lot about Voidulovsky, a lot about Ehrenburg, and a lot about, because Ehrenburg, although he was very famous, this work of his was not famous at all. And Shalikov, I did a lot of close readings. I'm one of those historians that gets into trouble with other historians for being too much like a literary scholar, and so when you read reviews of my book, you can sort of see people saying, well, she focused, she went back to the same work many times. Well, yes, because in some sense I'm doing a literary study of those works, and so I did an extended study of several different works, and then I tried to fill in with details from a broader array of works. That's a good question.
Yes, thank you. Do you think that the Russians forgot about World War I in the 20s and 30s, or that the works they discussed were the margins, because Civil War, then collectivization, and industrialization had basically torn apart the society, right? So there was no opportunity for people to really think about World War I.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's, I mean, if you look at the Civil War is so destructive. World War I is very destructive, but Civil War is even more destructive of life, and then there's a famine, and so that I think in the 1920s, a lot of why people are not focusing on the memory of either war is that they're struggling to survive. You know, it's a society whose fabric is rent in many different ways. So I agree with you that's why it's not in the center. But even if it had been. Even if there had been people who wanted to really, you know, sort of push it, I think then the censorship would have pushed them back, right? You know, so this was never going to be a centerpiece of Soviet discourse, right? Just because the Soviet, you know, the government didn't want to emphasize World War I. But the fact is that people lost track of where their relatives were buried. The cemeteries were falling apart. It's important to understand Soviet views of death and dying, right? Because they were an atheist state, they were deeply uncomfortable with Orthodox Christian burial rituals, and so they hated cemeteries, right? And one of the things that they did was they allowed cemeteries to go into disrepair, and then they bulldozed them. You know, they would just take the stones and bulldoze them, they did this in part because they were anxious about the fact that atheists don't have an afterlife, and it wasn't a very comfortable mix, but they also mixed everybody indiscriminately together. The dead were not separated out, so that I think I suppose this is true of many war cemeteries that the dead of both sides are buried together. But the Soviets took it to a new new level, where they were burying the World War I dead, the Civil War dead, the victims of the Red Terror, the people that they were executing. Everybody was just put all together in these cemeteries, so that the cemetery or these places couldn't become places of honor, because they were just this utilitarian place to dispose of dead bodies, and that's part of why. You know, sort of the fabric of memory and the fabric of these dead. These dead are not commemorated in a way. Even the Civil War dead are not commemorated in a really coherent way, and that's also part of this problem.
Over here,
yes,
yes.
That's me.
Yeah.
So, was there like a lost generation in Russia as a result of the World War?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing: is that that's a really good question. The generation was that generation that was the equivalent of the lost generation. It's not clear to me how well they survived, right? I mean, that you have to be alive to be lost, right? And I think in some ways, by the time you had World War I and then the Civil War, and then followed up in 1928 by the upheavals of collectivization and industrialization, there was just constant trauma. And so no generation was identified that way, the way it was in the West, because all generations were experiencing some kind of trauma or other in that decade. And so World War I is not singled out, because there's just trauma upon trauma upon trauma. So, there's, if you, together, World War I and the Civil War, they argue there's about 30 million excess deaths. So that includes the people who died, but also the people who weren't born because of the deaths, right? So it's demographic loss is 30 million. And that's a considerable, that's a cataclysm. So the answer is yes and no. There's a lost generation, but it's everybody, isn't it? Right? There's not, just not just the men who fought in World War I or the Civil War, but really everybody is in bad shape.
Can you talk a bit about the conflict over whether to bury Lenin or keep him preserved?
Sure. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So it's a very strange thing, right? I wish I had I don't have my slide of this. Well, maybe if you give me a second, maybe I can. It's not worth it. You can look it up on the web. Okay, so here's a very strange thing. This is a society that does not venerate the dead. There's a jumble. The cemeteries are a wreck. And then Lenin dies. And it's a very strange thing that happens. They decide, because Lenin is this central figure that's going to hold everything together in terms of legitimacy, that they decide that first it's kind of a temporary thing, that they're going to embalm him for a few days so that everybody who wants to see him can see him before he is buried. And then all of a sudden, he's not going to be buried, right? And so there are different opinions about this, about what happened, but it seems pretty clear that the Lenin's successors are trying to use Lenin as a symbol for legitimacy, and they decided that the best way to use him is to keep him alive, right? And so they embalm him, and then put him in Red Square, where everybody can visit him, and he's still there today. I don't know that it's still open today, but he is still embalmed and still in a tomb in Red Square. Now, the Soviets were very utopian, right? There's a lot of, in that first decade of the 1920s, there's an incredible amount of utopian thinking going on. And one strain of that thinking was that science was going to overcome death. And so I don't know if any of you know that Walt Disney was frozen, right? But the sort of the same idea, right? That if you freeze Walt Disney or embalm Lenin, then when we figure out how to resurrect people, he'll be ready to go. So there's an incredible utopian strain about why Lenin is kept embalmed, and then he became part of the Soviet state, and I don't know why they don't bury him now. I mean, it seems like he always wanted to be buried next to his mother. I think those were his final wishes. And he's obviously not buried next to his mother. He's in Red Square still.
Tourist attraction.
Any further questions? If not, we'll move to... we do have a copy of Professor Petron's first book, and we'll try to fill all that. I'll get the... And we have a couple. We did order extra copies of her newest book, and they haven't all arrived. We have a couple copies here, so if you'd like to get one. More are coming, and if you want one, we can have you sign a. I think they have an insert for the book.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd be happy to do that.
All right. So.
I get to pick up.
You get to pick, and we'll see who's the lucky person.
All right. And the winner is Marco.
Professor Petron will be happy to sign that for you. And of course, we do have a couple of.
The fix was, I shut my eyes, I didn't.
to give away.
Oh, that's nice.
And let you pick one of these.
Dusty glass.
Dusty? Maybe we'll do one more. Get our Dean of Libraries to pick one. Celeste Jackson. Celeste? Well, and we have a very special gift for you tonight. We were talking about one of our famous recently discovered monuments at Western is referred to as the Sputnik chandelier, which it once proudly hung in our garret, the student center, and then was thought to be archaic and was removed in the 1960s and housed, found in a closet recently, and now been restored to grandeur in the third floor of the Kentucky Museum. So, your very own Sputnik.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, want to thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Please feel free to come up and chat with our speaker, and we have a couple copies of your book if you'd like to get.
Absolutely.